and it's more than I hoped for, but it's less surprising than my performance on the Blockhouse for me personally.
Well, Daniel, that's Tom Dumoulin talking after his stage win, which has given him the pink jersey as, well, he held it last year, didn't he? Twice. Held it, then lost it. And this year he's got it after the wine trial here in Montefalco. Are we going to kick off the episode of the cycling podcast, or are we going to go to the buffet and see if we can get a little glass of the local vino?
The good thing about the wine trial was there was no, although there was a Tom Dumoulin's just coming in the Maliaros, there was no rosé. Thank God. Thank God for that.
Well, let's go and see what's on offer, and then we'll kick off this episode.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Montefalco.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Well, Daniel, we're now outside the press room here in Montefalco.
Do you know what we've done, Lionel? We've decanted. Oh, and the wine's just decanted over the results sheet. Oh, no. What a disaster. Anyway, let's try and stay professional. Let's just carry on. Let's pretend it didn't happen. Let's pretend we're not drinking wine.
Yeah. Well, you've lost the wine trial, haven't you, there? I still have a little half glass of wine.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's disappointing, isn't it? We'd better talk about the Giro d'Italia,
let's not
really,
cry over spilt Rosso di Montefalco.
Well, it was stage 10 of the Giro d'Italia, and as expected, Tom Dumoulin won the 39-kilometre wine trial from Foligno to Montefalco, and his margin of victory was very impressive. Just as impressive, in fact, was Geraint Thomas' performance, because he was second just a couple of days after that crash on the road to Blockhouse. Thomas was just 49 seconds behind. Third was Bob Jungels, who'd lost the pink jersey at Blockhouse, and so he shot back up to sixth place overall. Vincenzo Nibali was next best of the overall contenders in sixth place, 2:07 behind Dumoulin. And after that, it's really a tale of damage done, because Malcolm Olmer was at 2:17, Thibaut Pinot at 2:42, that's certainly under par for him, and Nairo Quintana at 2:53. So Dumoulin has the pink jersey, as he did last year, and a quite a handsome looking 2:23 lead over Quintana. Mollema, Pino and Nibali are backed up, and they're the only three that are within 3 minutes. And as I'm speaking, Tom Dumoulin is walking past with quite a large bottle of Montefalco wine and a rather nice vase, so not a bad day's work.
Don't think he's coming to talk on the podcast, though, is he?
No, he was walking too quickly for that.
He was looking longingly over, but I don't think he's coming.
I think he was looking the other way.
Maybe tomorrow.
Anyway, it means that the Giro is now really finely balanced, because we've got Dumoulin in the lead and we have the climbers who are playing catch-up. That's the likes of Quintana, Pino and Nibali. They've got to attack. Another thing that caught the eye was the performance of Adam Yates. I mean, astonishing, really, because not a noted time trialist, but he finished 17th ahead of Pino and Quintana. And you are left wondering what might have been for the two British riders in who were here with overall ambitions, because like Thomas, he may well be in the top three or four but for Sunday's crash. So we have Dumoulin in pink, we still have Gaviria in Chicolomino and Polanch in blue as King of the Mountains. Bob Jungels is back in the white jersey, and tomorrow's stage to Bagno di Romagna has a second category climb not far from the finish, which may see the first forays, first attacks.
Monte Fumaiolo, one of Pantani's, Marco Pantani's old haunts. It's very much I think the Pantani stage, we have a Pantani stage, don't we? And I think it's the stage over the Mortirolo. But tomorrow is the real Pantani stage.
Well, what do we make of the time trial today, Daniel? Because the Giro have made this a bit of a tradition, haven't they? The wine trial. You were running me through the other regions that have hosted the time trial. I think it's a stroke of genius, because the countryside's fantastic. If anyone watching on TV, it was a real treat. The sun's shining, it's lovely and warm, beautiful vineyards, kind of gentle hills in the background. Stunning part of Umbria, this, isn't it? And when I think of some of the sort of stodgy, turgid Tour de France time trials that go through pretty nondescript
countryside. I hope Prudy doesn't listen to our Giro podcast. We'll never get invited back, will we?
Well, Italy is blessed with many beautiful places, but it is noticeable now we've moved up into this region just how stunning the countryside has become. And the wine trial, it's becoming a winning formula, isn't it?
It is. It is. We're going to hear more about the wine trial later. We're going to go into some depth, some detail about the wine trial. But the results in general, Lionel, just looking at the winners and the losers today. I mean, I think we talked about what was par the other day at Blockhouse. That we thought that Nairo Quintana's win had maybe been even slightly below par, or that we talked about 1-0 win in the first leg of a Champions League game at home. Today, I thought Dumoulin did well. I think 2 minutes 20 seconds over Quintana, he would have taken that if you'd offered it to him at the start of the race. I mean, Pino, I thought, would go better, but he's taken more seconds off Quintana. He's got slightly closer. And, you know, those two are pretty much on an even footing when it comes to climbing and time trialing. Pino is just as much of a climber as Quintana, and he's just as much of a time trialist, or slightly better time trialist. So, you know, he's someone who doesn't need to have a big advantage going into the final time trial from Monza to Milan. In fact, he could possibly regain time on Quintana. So Quintana, I would say, is the big loser. Nibali was solid. I think he's actually riding, I mean, I know we're very early in the race, but Nibali's riding a pretty good Grand Tour at the moment, a pretty good Giro. He was sixth on the stage, which, you know, it's pretty decent when you consider there were three or four pure time trialists in the field. And Thomas, I don't know if this is true. Did this pass me by, Lionel? But is it true that Geraint Thomas rode faster at Blockhouse than Quintana? Someone told me that today. If it is true, it's astonishing. If it's nearly true, it's also astonishing. And it also proves what brilliant form Thomas is in. And he proved that today, didn't he?
Well, not only the form, but the strength of character and the sort of physical robustness. I mean, he's only a slight fellow, isn't he? But, you know, he has had his fair share of knocks and bashes over the years. I remember when he was still a teenager, part of the British track squad. He crashed very badly on a training ride, or perhaps riding to the velodrome somewhere in Australia for a World Cup. I think it must have been Melbourne.
Before the Bendigo Criterium.
He crashed so badly he had to have his spleen removed. And, you know, he's been in the wars. He's no stranger to picking himself up. But I had no sense really on Sunday night, as calm and as kind of well as he was taking it, that he would be able to pull out that kind of performance. And it's a real shame, because clearly he's in absolutely fantastic form, and we won't know just how close to Dumoulin and Quintana and the rest he could have got had that crash not happened.
And Lionel, the Italians are really taking to him. I mean, they were full of praise for him on Rai television, Italian state television, on Sunday night after he got up off the deck and rode very well into the finish at Blockhouse. And I know there are a couple of there might be an Italian agent or two fishing around hoping to sign him up on their books, because they are, you know, the Italians think that he could be one of the next big stars in Grand Tours. He hasn't got an awful lot of time left in his career, but what we've seen so far has been pretty encouraging.
Yeah, just looking ahead to the rest of the race for Thomas, and obviously the injuries and what have you may well, you know, come out in the wash, so to speak, over the coming days. And there might come a point where he gets, you know, it's just too much. We don't know. But one thing, when somebody crashes out of contention, so to speak, the temptation is to think, well, now maybe they can take the foot off the gas and try and go for stage wins. But actually, I was talking to Brett Lancaster, the Sky sports director, about this, and we were talking about this, Daniel, weren't we, that the smarter move would be to ride GC, ride for the overall classification, as if he was still right up there in contention. Try and stay on the coattails and see. He's got a great opportunity with less pressure. He's got great opportunity to see just how far his legs could carry him.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a massive difference between riding with no pressure for stage wins and sitting up in the mountains and trying to dig in every day, which is something that Geraint Thomas has never done in his career. He's never had to do that. And that is the big unknown with Geraint Thomas. Can he do that? So this is a perfect opportunity for him to test his ability on that front. And I think, you know, if he rides to his level, I think unfortunately, other riders will fall by the wayside. They'll get ill. They'll crash. They'll be out of form. And I think the podium is still a possibility for Thomas. I think the same about Adam Yates. Adam Yates is now 16th on general classification. Again, for him, you know, this is very much about the future, his future as a Grand Tour rider. And I don't think he would learn that much necessarily from cherry picking a couple of stages and possibly winning a stage. I think he would be much better served to ride like a GC contender, try to stay with the favourites. And like I say, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that he could still finish on the podium.
What do we make of Tom Dumoulin then? Because last year at the Giro, there was all the talk when he was in the pink jersey, how far are you going to go? Do you think you can contend? Because he was coming into the Giro on the back of the Vuelta the previous year, which he very nearly won. He blew up right at the end, didn't he? And in the end, Dumoulin went home with supposedly a saddle sore, but the rumours that was just a bit of a ruse to get him out of the race. But this year,
if Jürgen Klinsmann ever had a saddle sore, it was about as bad as Tom Dumoulin's saddle sore last year.
When did Jürgen Klinsmann have a saddle sore?
Well, I'm maybe suggesting that the saddle sore was a little bit of poetic creative license.
I think there was. I think when a team calls a big press gathering to tell you that the rider's got a saddle sore, that means he hasn't got a saddle sore. Anyway, that was last year. This year, there's no doubting that Dumoulin is here for the duration. He's in a great position now, 2:23, and just looking at the way he rode on Etna, he was one of the few aggressors on Etna. He rode brilliantly the other day at Blockhouse because I was hearing that, you know, he could maybe have gone with, but he chose to just not go into the red too early and to use the climb to his advantage and use the gradient, so he was putting the pressure on the bits that really suited him and just holding back a little bit on the bits that didn't suit him. And he rode fantastically. He's now in a position where 2:23, it's a great advantage, but it's not enough, is it? But then with the final time trial to come, he could afford to lose the pink jersey and go into that. I mean, we're looking so far. I don't do speculation, but I'm being forced. I'm getting carried away already.
Well, Lionel, we're going to hear. We don't know when we're going to hear from him yet, but the interview's in the bag with Laurens ten Dam, teammate of Tom Dumoulin at Sunweb. I spoke to him this morning. He was very interesting about Tom Dumoulin and the help that Laurens ten Dam has tried to give Tom Dumoulin and how he's approaching this race. We're going to hear from him. We don't know. It could be tomorrow. It could be the day after. And we're also going to hear from one of our colleagues soon, aren't we? Hans Rugenberg. Stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Scott Davis of Team Wiggins, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. My favourite ride is start in Carmarthen, where I'm from, head down to Llandeilo, to another place called Rhydaman, up the Black Mountain, down to Llandarog, over to Llandyfri, back through Brechfa, back to Carmarthen. When I was like 16, 17, there'd be like a group of us go out at 6 a.m. on a Sunday. Yeah, they're just really nice roads to ride on.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Ciao a tutti, sono Pier Bergonzi. I'm the deputy editor of La Gazzetta dello Sport. I'm a very fan of cycling. This is my 30th Giro d'Italia and I love wine. I'm also sommelier. And so this is my stage, the wine stage. And if you think which are the best country for cycling, and the best country for cycling, you think to France and Italy. From France and from Italy, there comes the best wine in the world, and maybe the cycling with the best tradition. I'm a sommelier. I became a sommelier just because cycling. Because this is my 30th Giro d'Italia, and every year when I came to the Giro d'Italia, it was good for me to taste the best plate, the best food, and the best wine of the region, of the terroir. And year by year, I understood something more about wine. And finally, I made the 3 years course of sommelier to become sommelier. and now wine, like cycling, is one of my passion, big passion.
Pierre, just lastly, we've had the Barolo. We call it the wine trial now, not the time trial, the wine trial. Yeah. We had the Barolo stage, we had the Prosecco, Chianti, and Sagrantino di Montefalco is less well known outside of Italy. Tell us about the wine.
It's less known, but is one of the big, big Italian wine, one of the great Italian wine. Red wine was a big personality, big character. Is the darkest wine in Italy. Is a red near black. It's black, very black wine, more than red wine. And tannin is very aggressive. And it's important to wait some years, because after 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years, the tannin is becoming sweet, and the wine is... So it can become a 25, 30 years very, very good wine.
Well, we heard a little bit there about the wine, Daniel. I mean, it doesn't really work for the listeners, does it? They can't taste it. I'm sure they can go and buy a bottle.
You certainly did last night. We all did, didn't we?
Yeah, a rest day evening. That's perfectly legitimate,
allowed,
surely.
Allowed.
What should people be buying? What should they go and get from the supermarket or wherever?
Pierre Bergonzi talked there about the two wines from Montefalco. Sagrantino is like the big brother. And the Rosso di Montefalco is aged for a shorter period of time, and it's therefore cheaper. But if you find either of them, you know, they're both excellent, highly recommended by the Cycling Podcast. But Lionel, we've been joined by the second best looking Dutchman at the Giro d'Italia. The first, the best clearly being Tom Dumoulin, the second being Hans Rugenberg of The Telegraph. Hans, a fantastic result for Tom Dumoulin today, but he said in the press conference he wasn't surprised.
No, he wasn't surprised, because he's focused on this time trial for the last 2 weeks before the Giro. He went to Liège, Bastogne-Liège, and then he said, I'm going to train on this time trial. Because he got a wake-up call at the Tirreno when he was 13th in the time trial, and then he thought, I can't take it easy on a time trial. I have to focus and I have to stay. I have to train some more to get into this time trial shape again. And he proved today that he was. He crushed everybody.
Hans, we're still a bit dubious about how long he's going to last in this Giro, like whether he can really survive the high mountains in the Dolomites, and you know, climbs like the Stelvio and the Mortirolo. He's obviously looking pretty good at the moment, 2:20, but do you think he's really got a chance of winning this race?
Bauke Mollema thinks so, because I spoke to him right after the race and I asked him, is he a serious competitor for the podium? He said, not for the podium, I think he can win this thing. And if I go to myself, I think he can win it, because he showed on Blockhouse he's a good climber, and he climbs cleverly. He climbs on his own pace. He doesn't panic when Quintana goes away. He doesn't panic at all. So when he's in his own tempo, he can do this kind of climbs. He trained on this the last year after Giro. He only trained on climbing and the classifications. Being good in the classification. So if he stays in his shape, and I think maybe he can get a little bit better, then they got a really tough guy to beat here, because he's also got the time trial in Milan. So I think they have to gain 4 or 5 minutes on him to win the Giro d'Italia, otherwise Tom Dumoulin wins it.
4 or 5 minutes? He's going to get 4 or 5 minutes in the time trial in Milan?
No, he's got 2.5 now. So that's what I mean. And if he got 1.5 in Milan as well, then he got 4. So they have to think that way. We have to gain 4 minutes on him. Otherwise, we're not going to win this.
How is the Giro d'Italia going down back in the Netherlands? Because you've got 3 riders in the top 10, 2 in the top 3 at the moment. What's the reaction like back at home?
Well, the football season is over now. So I think the focus is going to be on cycling more and more, because... we only got Ajax in the Europa League final, but
I hope they win.
Yeah, me too, and all the Dutchies are hoping that. But getting the pink in the Giro d'Italia is a big thing in Holland as well. Getting the leader jersey in a great big round. So, and when if he's keeping it, and I think he's going to keep it for the next week. The people in Holland, the cycling fans, they're all cycling fans. You know, Holland is a bicycle country. And it's getting more and more hyped, I think, for the next few weeks.
And this morning I spoke to Laurens ten Dam. Of course, he knows them all well. He's ridden with all of them for a number of years. Dumoulin, Kruiswijk, and Mollema. And he was very interesting about how Mollema is very much his own man. He's quite quiet in the team. He does his own thing, whereas Tom Dumoulin is someone who really tries to bring the team together and interacts a lot with his teammates. I mean, how would you characterize their three different personalities, Kruijswijk, Mollema and Dumoulin?
Yeah, I think Mollema is focused on his own thing mostly, and when he goes in the bus to the start, he gets a book, he reads the book. When he goes to his room, he reads a book. So he's not really interacting with his teammates, and that's how he showed in the big rounds in the Tour de France that he can be a good competitor for the GC. That's the way it works for him. Kruijswijk is also focused on his own things, but last year he showed, or the team showed, that he needs a big team, a good team to help him. If the team is good enough here, I don't know, but and that he has to tell them what to do in a way. He's learning to be more a leader, although he's already 29 years old. If you see Dumoulin, he's different to both of them because he's really interacting and sometimes a little bit too much because he want to do things that's for the captain of the team, like Laurens ten Am, or maybe for Eike Visbeek or Luke Roberts, the sports director. So maybe he's want to do too much sometimes.
You mean he wants to be the director as well as the star rider?
Yeah, maybe the manager as well of the team. No, well, he must focus on cycling, and that's the thing. And of course he has to tell his teammates what to do, and he does that because he's charismatic, and if he says something, they will do it for him. But not the things discussing what kind of dinner or something like that. And sometimes he does too much those kind of things as well. And he has to let it loose. And if he can do that...
It's the opposite of Lionel. Well, Lionel... no, actually, it's exactly the same as Lionel, isn't it? But I would... Wow. That he's talking too much about where to have dinner and how to have dinner. No, it's exactly the same as you.
Yeah, well, it's knocking on, isn't it? It's at 10 to 7. We need to, wind this up a bit.
Well, I don't know if it's the same because I don't know Lionel very, very good. But, Tom has to focus, and he's focusing now on the race because what he showed today, that's a mental thing as well. He said my legs weren't as good as I thought, but that's the way how you win races. If you feel your legs are hurting too much, then it comes to the mental thing, and he's so good at that, and he learned to go on if it hurts and hurts more than if it hurts more than his competitors, he can go on.
Interesting hearing the Dutch perspective there, Daniel. I thought, to labour your football analogy, I thought Dumoulin's performance today was a real sort of comfortable 3-0 home win when expected to win, deliver the goods.
Everyone went home happy.
Everyone went home happy. And it really, we were kind of bemoaning the fact that the race was so slow to get going. But in a couple of days of racing, we've seen the pendulum swing wildly one way and the other. Of course, the incident with Geraint Thomas, Mikel Landa, and to a lesser extent, Adam Yates, very unfortunate, not the kind of incident we want to see. But it did inject a dimension to the race, at least. And we are still wondering, what might have been for those three guys. And yet, when you look at the top 10, and even a little bit further down, from Quintana down to certainly Pozzovivo in seventh, only a minute and a half, it's still very well balanced for people to have good and bad days in the mountains. And of course, everybody, Dumoulin has had a big old target on his back, doesn't he?
He does, Lionel. It was interesting to hear Hans talk there about the contrasting sort of leadership styles of Dumoulin and Mollema. It reminded me a little bit of the interview that Giovanni Visconti gave to Corriere della Sera this morning, it was published this morning. Visconti, of course, rode for Movistar and rode for Quintana under Quintana for a long time, and is now with Bahrain, Merida, and Nibali. And he talked about how Quintana is really, he's this kind of, this sultan, is sultanic a word? I don't think it is. Not satanic, but he's always this sultan that kind of glides around the place, not saying very much. He has this sort of mystical air around him in the team. But Visconti says he also doesn't really communicate very much with his teammates. And this can make him come across as slightly arrogant or slightly aloof. And in fact, Visconti had a bit of a confrontation with him at the 2014 Vuelta because Visconti said he was acting almost like a godfather in the team. And Quintana apologised and then apparently changed his approach a little bit. But you know, Nibali is completely the opposite. In fact, Visconti said you couldn't meet two more different people. Nibali is very spontaneous. He quite similar to Geraint Thomas, I think, in personality. He tends to say exactly what he thinks. He doesn't really calculate too much. And Mollema and Dumoulin sound as though they're cut from similar cloth, Mollema. Similar to orange cloth. Yeah, and well, Mollema similar to Quintana and Dumoulin to Nibali and Thomas, the riders I just mentioned. So, you know, a few interesting little subplots bubbling away. The Dutch are certainly enjoying this race. Kruiswijk didn't have a particularly good day today. He is now down in 10th place on general classification, 5 minutes and 19 down on Dumoulin. But yeah, they've got three riders still with some chance of making the podium in Milan. I was talking to the Sunweb press officer this morning, Peter Reef, and I said it'd be much, the Dutch journalists are enjoying it, but they'd be enjoying it much more if those three hated each other. But they seem to get on very well.
Well, yeah, we've talked about this a little bit, haven't we? The phenomenon of the Dutch football team all falling out on the eve of major championships. But yeah, it's slightly disappointing that they all seem to get on quite well. That's, it'd be
quite
great.
Incongruous, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, listen, Daniel, we need to start thinking about getting away from Montefalco. The race is really accelerating north, isn't it?
More to come now. More to
come. There is more to come. But I'm just trying to set up a little gag here that I want you to guess who I had in the back of our Maserati yesterday. Well, he's actually sitting in the front. I'm going to pick up Daniel Lloyd, who's working on the race with the RCS organisation. He's part of the commentary team, providing commentary for the World Feed, which any broadcaster in the world can pick up. And Dan Lloyd rode his first Grand Tour at the Giro d'Italia in 2009. He rode again in 2010, and I thought he'd have some interesting stories to tell about the race.
The Cycling Podcast on the road at the Giro d'Italia with Maserati.
Hello.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Where do you want to go?
Well, you said you were going to take me for a spin in the Maserati, which I thought I'd take you up on, so wherever you want, really.
I was going to ask you, Dan, you did your first Grand Tour at the Giro in 2009. You'd ridden at progressively increasing levels, hadn't you? But what was it about the first Giro you did that really sort of opened your eyes?
I remember the very first mountain stage of the race. It started to get fast, of course, of 15, 20k to go to the first mountain. I remember Liquigas being on the front. And I started to get a bit nervous because we were loitering at the back. My job was just to stick on the wheel of Carlos. So I went up to him at a point and said, "Do you think maybe we should start moving forward a little bit here?" He said, no, we're okay. Just stay here for now. And then we got 5k to the mountain. We were still in exactly the same place. And I said, "You know, maybe we should just move up, Carlos, because it's really starting to get fast now." And he said, "No, Dan, if I need your help, I'll ask you to come round me, but I'm happy here. Just stay on my wheel in case I have any problems." Anyway, we arrived at the foot of this first mountain, still in the last 20 riders, and I thought, well, he's obviously just not up for this race. You know, he's come here with ambitions and telling everyone he wants to be up there overall, but we're at the back on the first mountain. Anyway, people way in front of me were calling Gruppetto, which is obviously the group that forms at the back of the race, full of sprinters and non-climbers who just want to get through. And Carlos just weaved his way through a load of people who were just stopping effectively in the road. Later on that evening, and when I got to the bus afterwards, I found out he'd come somewhere in the top five. So he was just a very relaxed rider who just didn't want the stress of being at the front. But there was one stage in particular at the end of 2010. I think it was the penultimate day. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was. We went over the Gavia and a couple of other very, very high climbs and mountains. And we had to get somebody into the breakaway. And a little bit like Cannondale, we didn't manage it. And so we were sent to the front pretty soon after that. And it was a long old stage as well. And of course, being non-climbers, you're the first people to do the work because you've got to save the climbers for the climbs. So myself and Gabriel Rash and I think Ted King, we all set to work at the front to reduce the gap, which we managed, but we did it on the only sort of 30-kilometre stretch that day that was flat or slightly downhill. As soon as we got to the climbers, of course, you know, the climbers attacked, and I think we did end up getting somebody in the breakaway, but just getting through that stage was horrific because all of the hardest point was still to come. And poor old Gabriel Rash, who incidentally invented the Gabba jersey, so all of you out there who are wearing Gabba jerseys, that was one of his ideas, he didn't finish the stage. So the next day was a time trial into Milan that finished the race off, and poor old Gabba had to pull out the day before.
And what do you think of the car?
Yeah, nice. Pretty big. I know that you've been saying it's quite big to get through some of the narrow streets, but I'd like one.
We'll see what we can do, Dan.
The Cycling Podcast, on the road at the Giro d'Italia with Maserati. Visit maserati.co.uk to find out more about the new Levante, the Maserati of SUVs. Yours from £56,250 on the road.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you'd like 20% off all Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and when you check out, enter the code CPOD20, C-P-O-D-2-0. There's another Science in Sport offer coming tomorrow. We'll have details of that in tomorrow night's podcast after Stage 11. Now, Daniel, it was a rest day yesterday and you disappeared off for a couple of hours. I heard a rumour that you had a meeting with the mayor of Foligno.
Kind of, Lionel, kind of. Should we hear a bit more about what I was up to?
All right, the big story we're following this morning is what's happening in Italy. The death toll rising overnight from a powerful earthquake. It measured 6.2. It struck in the mountains of central Italy. At least 38 people now dead. Let's go live to Barbie Nadeau. She's a CNN.
Vice Sindaco di Visto, Spigatti, Maurizio Gianluigi.
The situation is the same today as it was on October 30th. We have to thank the fire service, which is still trying to make our village safe again. The police, the carabinieri, the army. The politicians have just paraded around doing nothing.
Mayor of Montefalco, Donatella Tesei.
95% of Umbria is still inhabitable. We have to send a strong message because our economy relies on it. Our towns are so beautiful and so welcoming. They don't deserve to lose out. We need to send this message so the whole region can rise up again.
E questo serve all'intera regione proprio per rinascere.
Ah sì, metà delle località qui presenti oggi e anche molte di quelle che simbolicamente oggi erano presenti ma di fatto non.
Yes, I've been through half of the places affected and represented today with the Tirreno Adriatico. I know them all and have had direct contact with the mayors and the people living there over the years. Half of my heart is in these places, so obviously I got emotional today. What we don't want is for the world to forget about these areas after all the attention and once the spotlights have gone off. This is a promise that we're making today, to say that we'll always be here to watch and make sure that things go the way they should go. Donating a bike is nothing, but it's a symbolic gesture to say that we need to rebuild and rebuild together.
Cominciano ad andare nel verso giusto. Donare una bicicletta non è niente, ma è il simbolo per dire bisogna ripartire, ripartiamo insieme.
So the last voice we heard there, Lionel, was Mara Venghi. The event that I attended yesterday, you'll probably have gathered, was an event organised by the Giro in support, really, of the victims of the earthquake, or the earthquakes, the two major earthquakes that hit central Italy at the end of last year, September and October last year. And it's this area of Italy, not where we are today, Montefalco, which was kind of spared the worst of the damage, but a little bit further east of here, there are still a lot of communities that have been completely ravaged and completely destroyed. And you know, it's just speaking to a lot of local people in the last couple of days, the region, it's really the spectre of the earthquake and all the damage that it's wreaked really looms over everything they do at the moment, and it's costing them a huge amount of money. It's costing the Italian government a huge amount of money. We were talking to the lady who owned our hotel, the hotel where we were in the rest day today, and she was talking about how, you know, an awful lot of people, thousands and thousands of people, are still housed in hotels, and people who've lost their houses in the earthquake, and it's costing, well, it costs the Italian state about 40 euros a night to house these people in hotels. And it's you know, it's very sad, and it's very scary as well, because the earthquakes, well, earthquakes have hit this region of Italy at a rate of about, or major earthquakes at a rate of around one every 30 years. And yeah, this was a subject kind of fairly, I felt fairly attached to. I did a presentation on this in my for my university degree, earthquakes in central Italy, years and years ago, Lionel. But yeah, Maraveni said there, I think the important thing, well, the thing that he wanted to stress was that yesterday was about donating bicycles to the communities affected, but really what Italy needs to do, and what he hopes the Giro is going to do, or has promised the Giro is going to do, is just not forget these people, because that is what has happened before when earthquakes have hit this part of Italy.
Yeah, struck by, you know, just how many old buildings, how ancient the towns are, and how much devastation must be done when the earthquakes hit, and how difficult it must be to rebuild, and rebuild maintaining the character. I mean, it'd be all very well to just knock everything down and rebuild with sort of earthquake safe modern buildings, but that would completely change the character of the country and the character of these regions. And I think one of the things that the wine trial here, and the one last year in
Chianti
last year, and then before that was Barolo, and before that was Prosecco.
Other way around.
So, I mean, the whole point of these races really is to showcase the country, encourage tourism, and, you know, tell people that these regions are fine to visit, and that they may be getting back on their feet in certain aspects, but that they rely on the tourists to keep coming, and not just think, well, that area must be off limits.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. RAFA exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Going from one unfortunate story and very sad story to another.
Not quite in the same league. But
no, not quite. But people who didn't fare too well today, people who weren't very happy at the finish. TJ Van Garderen of BMC is having a bit of a nightmarish time here. Mm. He was, well, I spoke to Marco Pinotti, who is the coach at BMC, or one of the coaches at BMC, this morning, and he was obviously disappointed with Van Garderen's performance at Blockhouse the other day, but said that TJ was very motivated this morning, and he was convinced that he was going to do a good ride. And look at the results sheet, and
even with the wine smudging the print on there, we can't find him, can we?
But he's, no, it's fairly clear that he didn't do a particularly good ride. In fact, there he is in 43rd place. Mm. Not very happy at all. And he didn't want to speak to the media after the time trial. He looked pretty disconsolate. And the BMC Direct Sportif, Max Chandry, was left to field questions about Van Garderen and just what had gone wrong today. Max, we've just seen TJ come in. He's obviously not particularly happy with his performance. I mean, what was your view of it?
Well, you know, I mean, there's not much view. It's all about time. So the time trial is about timing. It's about result at the end. You know, it's clear and simple. It's not much tactic. You know, it's just personal pacing. And so, you know, yeah, wasn't the best. Not what we expected, but, you know, we're still here. We're still to fight. I don't want to really make too many conclusions right now. I just want to kind of take it in, see the final result, and then we'll take it from there.
How much pressure is TJ putting on himself, and how much is, you know, do you think that's causing him frustration, that most of the pressure is coming from himself?
No, well, we came here with good expectations, a good team around him, you know. Just obviously today was, I'd say, one of the first where we can kind of draw a little bit of a line and see how the first part of this Giro is going. Obviously, the second part is going to be, you know, we'll just take it from here, and we'll maybe change a little bit of strategy or play in a different way, you know, depending if we're around the 6 or 7 minutes, then it means we need to move, you know. So we'll see.
And just finally, it seems talking to some of the coaches in the team and talking to you that what happened today was similar to what happened at Blockhouse. He started the climb in Blockhouse pretty well and then faded in the second half, and same today.
Yeah, a little bit the same. I mean, I think he's slightly off pace. We had a little radio issue. That's not probably the case, but it's there's nothing really to time trial is just about speed and pacing yourself and putting it out, you know, and laying it all on the course. So yeah, he was a little bit off.
So that was Chandri, Lionel, and it's always sort of interesting, intriguing, but also quite sad really to see a rider whose, you know, career is not going the way that they want it to go, and that's been the case at Van Garderen for a while now. And and also you see the kind of pressure that he's putting on himself, you see the pressure that is being put on him, not necessarily in a direct way by his team, but purely by the fact that he's earning a lot of money, and everyone knows there's no secret about that. And you know, a certain level of performance is expected of someone who earns as much as him, and he's simply not capable of producing those performances at the moment. And you know, he's at a real crossroads in his career. I think he's coming to the end of his contract at the end of the year, and you have to ask yourself what kind of rider he's going to be in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem for TJ Van Garderen is he doesn't win any races, does he? I mean, he's won the Tour of California, and that's more or less it. I mean, he's on a big salary, one must assume, one of the sort of the big three at BMC Racing. It's not even as if he has to shoulder all of the team's responsibility all of the year round. What is curious is that he hasn't yet kind of switched and thought, well, why not ride smaller stage races, but with everything, you know, peak for the Tour of Romandy or Paris-Nice or something like that, and try and get a real sort of get a result in the bag. Because coming here to the Giro as the team leader with everything behind him and then performing the way he's performed at Blockhouse and then again in the time trial, where you would expect him to be able to pick up something, you know, you'd expect him to be higher than 43rd. It does raise questions about the not him, but the team strategy and what they're trying to do with him. You know, are they indulging him and allowing him to sort of say, yeah, I want to be leader for a Grand Tour, when perhaps he's just not really up to it at the moment?
Yeah, and the impression that we get with Van Garderen, and the impression we've got for a while, is that he's not particularly enjoying his job. But that is an impression from afar. He's not someone who has a great relationship with the media. He doesn't give an awful lot away. I think he's been burned a few times before. I think he's been burned by this sort of narrative that he was going to be the next great American stage racer, and that's not his fault. It's not necessarily the media's fault either, but there is a bit of a siege mentality now with the media, and you know, who knows what's going on in the guy's career and in his life. I mean, we expect these guys to turn up and produce the performances that our narrative suggests they should produce, but you know, who's to say that TJ Van Garderen was ever going to be a top five rider in a Tour de France or a top three rider in Grand Tours? He might simply be riding to the full extent of his potential at the moment, and in which case he just needs to, I suppose, reconcile himself to that and try to enjoy the rest of his career and get the most out of it that he can.
Very philosophical, Daniel. That.
Well, it's true, though, isn't it? I mean, you do feel bad for these guys. I mean, I saw him, you know, the curious thing about cycling is that everyone always gives their best. You know, in football and other sports, the players and protagonists often get accused of not wanting it, not being motivated. But we're pretty sure that everyone always gives their best in professional cycling.
Yeah, sometimes your number 10 doesn't want to play at Stoke away, do they? And I agree. I mean, cycling's too hard a sport to not put everything into it. And sometimes it can just be a case of just not having it in the head or in the legs. And yeah, it is unfortunate. And I suppose, you know, when you look at the Giro and the depth of the field here, it's pretty hard to come in here with for TJ Van Garderen to come in here with a sort of top five ambition, when, you know, it's quite a while since he's pulled a performance like that out.
Indeed, Lionel.
Well, we should probably think about making a move from here. We're heading up into Tuscany.
A new day, new region.
Another new region. Start in Florence tomorrow. Wonderful city. Went on the holiday there last year.
In the hometown of Gino Bartali.
Well, fantastic. I mean, you're one of the great legends of Italian cycling. Won the Giro before and after the Second World War. So we may well talk about Bartali tomorrow. In the meantime, just a couple of things to mention off the top of my head. I've got to try and remember all this. There's an episode of the cycling podcast Feminan, which came out today. That's Richard Moore, Ola Chenui, and Lizzie Deignan, Lizzie Armitstead, in conversation at Waterstones in Leeds. Richard's interview with Stephen Roach, the winner of the 1987 Giro d'Italia, is also available for friends of the podcast. A fantastic story, that the inter-team battle between Roberto Vicentini and Stephen Roach, and Roach gives his side of that story. Kilometre Zeros, Daniel, the mobile phone episode was
a few days ago.
I mean, it's created waves that, you know, Joe Dombrowski mentioned it again this morning. You know, he was saying that, you know, he was listening on his phone.
You were still on your phone when I came down to breakfast this morning.
The reason for that was because I went to bed thinking Watford had got a 3-3 draw at Chelsea last night and woke up this morning to find that they'd lost 4-3 with a goal in the last minute.
Were you checking how many people have listened to the mobile phone episode?
Yeah, no, I wasn't actually. What else has come out? There was something else. What else have we done? Oh, the double. We did a piece on the double for Kilometre Zero. Marco Pantani was the last.
You dropped your ice cream when we were trying to create a fantastic photo montage for the slide on Twitter.
Yeah, the picture is of, what was it? It was lemon ice cream and strawberry ice cream to represent the Maglia Rosa and the Maillot Jaune. And I was enjoying my ice cream and then dropped it. So, but anyway, that episode is about the double, the phenomenon, can it be done? A day ago, Nairo Quintana was in pink and looking great. Now he's got a job on his hands to try and win the Giro. We'll have another Kilometre Zero out in the morning, and the regular episode will return tomorrow evening after Stage 11. So in the meantime, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest. There's a special offer for the Eurosport Player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport Player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Thanks to them, and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who help keep us on the road, in particular David Luxton, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian, and Simon Gill. And thanks to Adam Bowie, who produced this episode.